The next case for argument this morning is Miller v. Honeywell. Mr. Winningham.
May it please the court. My name is William Winningham, and I represent the plaintiffs in this case, which is an appeal from a summary judgment ruling in favor of the defendants, Honeywell and Tedeco. This case arises from a helicopter crash on March 1 of 1997, and the parties agree that the crash was caused by the failure of a gear in the engine. There are two possible causes for the gear failure. One is that there could have been a defect in the gear, that being carbide networks, which could cause the gear to crack and fail. The other possible cause is the carrier misalignment, which can cause premature gear wear and failure. This leads to two different types of claims by the plaintiff. One is a product liability claim based upon the defect in the gear. And the second is a Section 324A assumption of duty claim based upon the carrier assembly misalignment. With regard to the product liability claim, it has been conceded by Honeywell that this gear had a manufacturing defect in it, that being the presence of carbide networks. Honeywell is defined in Indiana law as a manufacturer because they designed and wrote the specifications for the manufacturing process, the heat treat process that actually resulted in the defective carbide networks being in this gear. And the court so found that Honeywell was a manufacturer. So we have a manufacturing defect. We have the admission by Honeywell for summary judgment purposes that the defect was the proximate cause of the crash, and we have them labeled as a manufacturer under Indiana law. So they are strictly liable under our statute for the manufacturing defect. The only remaining issue is whether they participated in the distribution of this product into the stream of commerce. And there are several points there that are important. One is that they began the process that led to the eventual manufacture of this product. Without their design, there never would have been a product. Secondly, though, they had quality control standards they imposed upon the manufacturer, who was Precision Gear. They inspected the manufacturing facilities. There was a requirement that the manufacturer could not deviate from the Honeywell specifications without permission from Honeywell.
And they even back to the design defect. You have argued strenuously that 1991 is the time we should look at. But this product was manufactured in 1989, wasn't it?
This product was heat treated in 1989 and sold to the Army in 1991 after final manufacture.
So what sort of prescience should the heat treaters in 1989 have had to know what 1991 standards for heat treating were going to require?
Do you mean what should Honeywell be doing?
Why should Honeywell have treated it according to 1991 standards in 1989?
Honeywell was continuing to update their specifications as time went on.
I understand that, but
okay.
Why? I mean, if I were heat treating something today, you know, September 24th, 2003, would you criticize me for not applying September 2005 standards to what I was doing?
If you were aware that your specification was being used for 2005 manufacturer, then yes, you would have
but
a duty to update it.
How do I know what the 2005 standards are going to be when it isn't 2005 yet?
You wouldn't, but if you did learn,
and
they
so
did.
So how would Honeywell know? I'm sure, I mean, the point is, doesn't the focus have to be on what was known in 1999, not what was known in 1991, not what they thought was going to be good for 1997 or any other time? How can you ask somebody to anticipate future standards that don't exist yet?
It's when those future standards do exist and when there's more knowledge gained in the industry at that time, they should
but
update
those
specifications.
But you're saying it's the 1989 standards. You have to say that they knew in 1989 that the state of the art, as it were, required the kind of heat treatment that that you say should have happened. The district court found that there was no evidence, that maybe there are different ways of doing it, but there was no evidence to suggest that there was anything unreasonably dangerous about the methods Honeywell used.
And the district court was wrong there because there was cited by Dr. Wolfman a 1945 article on controlling carbon content, and there was a 1989 standard put out by the Gear Manufacturer Association as to carbon content control. So there was some evidence cited by our expert.
And how did you call this to the district court's attention?
It was in our summary judgment response and designation of evidence. But so you're right, there is a design defect case, but there, in addition to a manufacturing defect case, so we have two separate cases here. And the first point I was making is Honeywell is strictly liable under the manufacturing defect case because they are labeled as a manufacturer. And there is an issue as to the design defect.
How is it that they're a manufacturer?
Because under Indiana law,
they didn't make the part.
Right.
I thought your theory was that the specifications were a product that was sold.
No, our theory was that the gear was the product.
That's not your theory. It's not your theory that the specifications are a product.
Correct. Correct. The product is the gear that the specifications were utilized to create.
Then I'm completely lost because the gear wasn't made by Honeywell.
No, but under Indiana law, the designer of the product, Your Honor, is said to be a manufacturer under our statute. And it specifically mentioned that if you write the specification for the manufacturing process, you are a manufacturer. So a designer or a specification writer is, under Indiana law, by definition, a manufacturer. It's the statute that I'm specifically referring to. And that is what we rely upon for the manufacturing defect part of the case and their strict liability. And we also have a design defect issue, and that would also create liability, but it's a negligence-based standard for the design. It's strict liability for the manufacturing defect. The other part of our case against Honeywell is the Section 324A assumption of duty. And this is completely different than the Shamel versus Textron Lycoming case, because in our case, what happened was that Honeywell was paid through the 1980s and into the 1990s to revise and update the overhaul manuals that were used to overhaul this jet engine. In 1996, the new gears were put in. At that time, well before that, back in 1990 and 1991, Honeywell knew that the carrier assemblies were misaligned.
Suppose, to take other things Honeywell has done in its life, Honeywell designs a famous round thermostat, and it gets a patent on that thermostat in 1949, I believe, and patent expires. Somebody else makes a thermostat to the patented design 50 years later and sells it. Right, just copies out the Honeywell patent, makes the thermostat and sells it. And it turns out that that thermostat causes a fire. In your view, is Honeywell liable as the manufacturer of the thermostat because somebody copied out its patent?
Yeah, that's the very issue that Judge McKinney wrestled with, and he said in our case,
The district judge, I'm asking about does your view make somebody who copies out the product on a 50-year-old patent the manufacturer of that product?
Not if you had no reason to anticipate that that was going to happen. But in our case,
there was every reason to anticipate because patents only last for, actually the number of years has changed, but anyway, we'll say 20 years.
Right.
And then they are in the public domain, and every holder of a patent is aware that once the patent is expired, mm-hmm. it's going to face competition from, or at least potential competition from others.
We have, for example, lots of competition in generic drugs that are no longer under patent protection. And it sounds like your theory is that if Merck gets a patent on a drug, makes the drug for 20 years, the patent expires, a generic manufacturer comes along and makes the same drug, and there's a problem, Merck is liable.
No, I'm not saying that, and that's not what happened here.
The designer is the manufacturer under Indiana law, and I'm trying to see whether you're willing to take that seriously. It doesn't sound like it.
Well, by statute, Your Honor, the designer is the manufacturer.
Then you have to answer my question by saying that Honeywell is liable for a thermostat made 50 years later by somebody else, that Merck is liable for a generic drug made 30 years later by somebody else, and so on.
I think if
you don't answer that affirmatively, you don't have the courage of your convictions, and that suggests there's something funny going on here.
I think the problem with that would be that they would not have participated in putting the product into the stream of commerce by the connection with the manufacturer that occurred here, because Honeywell was involved in overseeing the manufacturing process, and I think that sets it apart from the example that you're asking about, Judge Easterbrook. But the 324A duty, we believe, was assumed by Honeywell to revise the overhaul manuals. It's been evidence that they were supposed to do that, and evidence they knew of a solution to gear repair through misalignment of the carrier assembly, and it's been evidence that it was not put into the overhaul manual. And if it would have been, the 1996 overhaul would have rectified the problem, and the carrier assembly misalignment would not have occurred, and it would not have been the gear failure. So that is the Section 324A duty that we have. It does not flow from Honeywell's status as the original designer or anything else. They were paid separately for these contracts with the Army to keep updated the Army overhaul manuals, and they failed in that obligation, and that's part of the reason why this crash occurred. Now, as to Tedeco...
Was that a tort or they committed, or did they breach their contract with the Army?
It's a tort.
Why is it a tort instead of a breach of contract?
It's an assumption of duty, and the duty can be based upon contractual undertakings, and that's Section 324A, which has been adopted in Indiana under that doctrine. Tedeco has asserted the government contractor defense. The first thing they must show is that the government approved reasonably precise specifications. But Tedeco patented this back in 1978 without the government ever being involved in it. Government was never allowed to view the Tedeco drawings of the design of their product. So without the ability for the government to view the drawings, they cannot be said to have approved reasonably precise specifications. In this case, they had failed on the first prong of the Boyle case. In addition, they must show that Tedeco warned the government of problems that Tedeco knew about but the government did not. And there were two problems. One was that the old magnetic shift detector was likely to detract to attract metal, which was indicative of engine failure, and not reported because it was disconnected from the warning light system. That was not said to the Army by Tedeco to be a problem, but it was a problem because one of the Tedeco engineers testified that it would have been good engineering judgment not to have it designed that way.
Well, the district court goes on for pages upon pages about the evidence in the record about the involvement of the Army. This is like a very bulky brief, as it were, not a brief, a long. But the district court really does set forth a huge amount of involvement in the Army in terms of what to do with these detectors, how to incorporate the new design in. Why isn't that plenty to say that the military contractor defense is available to Tedeco?
Because in addition to the government involvement, government must be warned of any danger that the manufacturer knows about but doesn't tell the government about. And it's clear the government was not warned by Tedeco in any way. And in fact, the government did not think this was a problem. They assumed that the old tip detector was inefficient. And it turned out they were wrong because when the accident happened, a bunch of metal was found attached to that very old tip detector that the government assumed was not going to be a problem. So Tedeco knew of the danger that the government did not.
Isn't it more accurate to say that in this record the trade-offs that were being made in these designs were trade-offs that the government was making in terms of the size of the debris that would be attracted by these detectors and whether it was better to keep the plug in or pull it back out or retrofit?
That would be a good argument if Tedeco was not aware of a danger and the government was aware of it, but that's not what we have here. With regard to the zapper, it's clear that Tedeco knew that it was important that even small particles could show abnormal wear because it's in their patent. Their patent had a zapper pulse counter that counted every time the zapper would zap even a very minute particle of 1 micron in size and indicated that that would be reported to the pilot when a certain frequency was reached. That was not included in the final design of this system on this helicopter, but Tedeco never told the government that it was important to have that feature included. And the government did not know it.
You can't be talking actually about the patent specifications. You must be talking about some trade secret. Patents are public. That's one of the trade-offs in the patent system. You can go sit and read patents all day if you have the attention span to do it.
Sure, but the point is that Tedeco, you can infer knowledge on Tedeco's part as to the fact that small micron-sized particles showing engine wear were important to know about. And
why
that's
not
why they
equally on the Army's part if it's a public document?
Because there's no evidence that Tedeco warned the Army of it, and that's the duty that
but
they have under Boyle.
That the Army could have sat down and read the patent and seen that this was a concern.
You know, they could have, you're right, but that would be a question of fact, I believe, for the jury to find out whether or not the warning that Tedeco gave or the lack of warning was reasonable or not. There is evidence that they did not provide a warning. Now, the Army could have known.
Do you have to warn about things that people already know about?
The Army did not realize this was important. The deposition testimony shows that the Army was unaware of the importance of small particle burn-off. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Winningham. Mr. Moeller.
May it please the Court, I'm Christian Mahler, appearing on behalf of Honeywell International, Inc. I want to just respond briefly to a couple of things that Mr. Winningham said at the outset. He pointed out that Honeywell, in its summary judgment motion, had conceded for purposes of the motion that there was a carburization defect in the gears. And that is true because in that motion we had been arguing that we didn't place the gears into the stream of commerce, and so whether there was a defect or not really made no difference for purposes of that argument. In fact, Honeywell did contest in the trial court below, and obviously Judge McKinney picked up on it, that there was any problem with the carburization in the gears. Another thing that I want to make sure that the court is aware of is Mr. Winningham said there were only two possible causes identified for this accident. There was, in fact, a third cause, as pointed out in our brief, which the Army concluded, which was that there was a dent found in the back of the gear that broke, and the crack originated from where that dent was in the carburized case. And that's what the Army concluded, was that the accident was due to the dent in the gear. Mr. Winningham also said, as plaintiffs have in their briefing, that Honeywell is responsible for Precision Gears manufacturing practices for these gears because it inspected the facilities at which they were manufactured. As we pointed out, there is no evidence to support that contention in the record. There was some testimony by a person in the buying area at Lycoming who said that he had gone and inspected some gears that were being sold to Lycoming. He said nothing about inspecting gears that were going to be sold to the Army and said nothing about inspecting machinery or processes. So there is no foundation for that contention in the record. Now, we've got basically two theories against Honeywell here, and there are a number of bases upon which the court can affirm the district court for each of them. The first being the allegation of defects in the carburization specification. The easiest basis, and the one that we made several times for the district court, was that under the Indiana Product Liability Act, and these claims are covered by the Act according to the Act's statement of its scope, Honeywell has to have somehow either sold, leased, or otherwise put the gears into the stream of commerce. Honeywell never touched these gears. It never had custody of the gears. It never had control of the gears. Precision Gear, under a separate breakout contract with the Army, contracted to take Honeywell's specification, which the Army owned and provided to it, make the gears to that specification, and sell them directly to the Army. The first time Honeywell ever saw these gears or touched them was after this helicopter had crashed. And the way that the Indiana statute is constructed, there is one section of the Act which imposes liability on the manufacturer. And in the iteration of the statute that we're dealing with, which is the one that was in effect in 1997 when this accident occurred, it is 33-1-1.5-3. The other sections that Mr. Winningham refers to, the ones that relate to definitions of manufacturer or that refer to a designer as a manufacturer, are all, they're either definitions or they are exceptions to that central section, which is the one that imposes liability. And so under the Indiana Act, unless one has placed the gear into the stream of commerce somehow, there can be no liability. The court based its decision on the fact, on the notion that somehow the specification T6030 was the product at issue here. And since plaintiffs have conceded that that is not the case, I don't think I need to address that unless the court wishes me to. The other bases upon which the court can affirm the district court's finding of no liability for Honeywell for defects in the gears are the inadequacies of Professor Walton's opinions about carburization defects in the specification. The critical claim that Professor Walton made that the specification was somehow defective or unreasonably dangerous, or actually the way he said it, it was an inferior specification, was this absence of carbon control. As we've indicated in our brief, the other specifications that he cited, none of them require carbon control. It's either it's recommended, It's something that's possible to do. It is not a requirement for production gearing. And in addition, all of those specifications that were cited came after the date of the Honeywell specification P6030 revision K, which is what these gears were carburized to, which was issued in 1988. Plaintiffs do cite to one 1945 article that was not in the summary judgment record below, and it wasn't referred to in the summary judgment record below. But even if it had been, there's nothing in that article that says that carbon control is a requirement for quality control for production gearing. The third basis upon which the court's finding on the gears can be affirmed is the temporal one that was which the court primarily relied on, which is the evidence had to be of a problem with the specification at the time that it was issued. Some negligence by Honeywell at that time in 1988, and there simply was no evidence of that. Turning to the claim with respect to the carrier assembly, as we had indicated, it was kind of a surprise to us when we made our summary judgment motion, long after expert disclosures, long after there had been a statement of final contentions by the plaintiffs, all of which focused on carburization defects in the gears, to have this carrier defect suddenly spring back to life, completely unsupported by any expert testimony, anything that would connect these events that happened at Aero Tool Company in 1990 with a carrier that had been manufactured by a completely different entity that was in the Army's custody as long ago as 1977. As we've also argued, another basis for affirming the finding on the carrier is that it is the claim, this Section 324A claim, is barred by the Indiana Product Liability Act. It's exclusivity provision. Shamel is actually a case that's very similar to this one. The only difference is the method by which the military procures products from contractors. In Shamel, which was a private aircraft case, Textron Lycoming sold some component to the general public, and 10 years later there was a crash that was attributed to a defect in product. In this instance, and what the court found in that case was that overhaul instructions for the product were part of the product, part of the manufacturer's obligation as a manufacturer of the product and as a seller of the product to provide to the general public. In this case, the way that the military buys products is it buys them under procurement contracts, and then it procures those same publication update services through subsequent contracts. Now, there really is no competent evidence in this case that Honeywell was even providing those kinds of services, that it was providing updates to the DIMOR contract. There was, at best, some testimony by a gentleman, Frank Stevens, who was the project engineer for the Army for the engine, and what he testified to was that other people handled publications. It was his understanding, and he thought that Honeywell was still providing publication updates, but it was really not, he really wasn't competent to provide that testimony. And in any event, there's nothing in the record that indicates what the scope of the undertaking was that Honeywell Lycoming had made with respect to those publications, whether it would simply be a printer, a carpenter, so to speak, whether it was to provide substantive input. There was no evidence about that at all, and without some sort of evidence of a specific undertaking by Honeywell, there can be no liability under Section 324A, even if it does provide a separate basis of liability. I want to just address very quickly one of the cases that plaintiffs rely on with respect to 324A, is the Stump case. The Stump case did not involve an action against the manufacturer, and it also involved the Indiana Product Liability Statute before the 1995 amendment to the Act. The 1995 amendment to the Act introduced the very broad scope provision that it presently has. This chapter governs all actions brought by a user or consumer against the manufacturer or seller for physical harm. previous iteration of the statute, the one that the court was dealing with in Stump, simply said it governed strict liability actions only.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller.
Thank you.
Mr. Eikenberry.
May it please the court, Dale Eikenberry. I'm here for Defendant Tedeco, one of the appellees in this case. Plaintiffs have really only focused in on two matters that they claim raise material issues of fact in the end in their reply brief, and they've talked about them very briefly here, and I wanted to address those. First, they talked about this was a patented device, or at least the Zapper was a patented device, and you didn't give the Army specific detailed drawings of it. That does not in and of itself create a material issue of fact to void contract of defense, as the judge in the district court found. In fact, the Army, as the record shows, knew everything it needed to know about how the Zapper worked, what this device did, what it was designed to do, how it disintegrated particle sizes in varying sizes. It had detailed, the Army had detailed specifications of this Zapper on file at the Army's laboratories at Fort Eustis, Virginia, where the 5 years of testing that occurred over this odd system had occurred from 78 to 83. The only thing the Army didn't have, and the only thing the record shows the Army didn't have, was a working drawing as to how you actually manufacture this. But that didn't detract from the Army's substantial knowledge about the workings of the Zapper device, which is the only thing that the plaintiffs are really pointing a finger at now. So to the extent that they argue that that somehow creates a question of fact, we believe it doesn't create a question of fact because the Army spent years researching this. They understood exactly how the device worked, and perhaps as important or more important, the Army on three occasions caused Tedeco to desensitize the system. One of those was to change the Zapper itself. The Zapper is the electrical part of the system which forces the electrical current to burn off debris, either a certain size or a number of particles. But that current is designed to bridge a gap in the detector which catches the debris. So that was desensitized after the Army, in fact, left the contract for this because the Army said to Tedeco, and it's in the record, this device is still too sensitive. We're getting way too many chip lights. One of the Army's main purposes in adopting the odd system and utilizing the Zapper in particular was the need to get away from all these chip lights causing all these precautionary landings and abortion of missions. The Army
did. Your opponent says, though, that even though that might have been a valuable thing to do for the Army, if somebody had said to the Army, but by the way, getting rid of all these lights is going to create a problem, even though it maybe solves one problem, it's going to create another problem, namely you're going to miss the information that you get from all the small particles.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the Army knew that. There is evidence in the record, particularly from the Army's report. There are three reports the Army submitted, or that we submitted, that the Army wrote, and there's another report authored by Wayne Hudgens, the aerospace engineer, and Dr. Talbert, one of Tedeco's employees, and in both of those they talk about the difficulty and the issues of how do you differentiate between what's significant and what isn't significant. The Army had this device, this counter device, on the system when it started its research and development program. The report 381 and 382, which are exhibits, which are Army reports, and the study that I just referred to, discusses that counter device was on the system. And the Army, in those reports, indicates that it made the decision to get rid of the device. And that was a decision made by Army engineers. So we believe as the district court judge did, it's readily apparent that engineers from the Army are making these decisions. They're making them based upon knowledge of the entirety of how this operates. Plus, there isn't anything in the record which says Tedeco knew that somehow not counting these minute particles of 1 or 2 micron sizes that no one can see was in any way connected with giving the Army an indication that there was an impending failure of a part in the aircraft. The patent that the plaintiffs want to rely upon, which they relied upon in their reply brief, and it's in the record, is a patent in 1981 for this counting device. It's our position that if the court reads the language of that patent that we've cited and that the plaintiffs cited, the only realistic conclusion is Tedeco didn't know or tell them that there's something wrong here if you don't count these minute particles. The significance of the size of particles had been something researched by the Army and by other people in the industry for years prior to the research and development program the Army did. And so the Army knew about this, and there isn't any evidence, we believe in the records, to suggest that Tedeco knew something about whether or not counting very small particles is indicative of an impending failure. All that patent talks about is the possibility of it might be nice information to know so you can schedule maintenance, or you can look at maintenance issues. But that patent was in 1981 that they're referring to, and the Army's decision and discussion about getting rid of the counter device, which the patent refers to, was in the 1982 publication. So the Army engineers had already made the decision, as we believe the district court found, not to need that. Because the issue here is, as plaintiffs do correctly point out, the issue is, did Tedeco know something that it didn't tell the Army that the Army didn't know? Now, we've discussed the counter device or the need for these small devices, but the other issue they raise is that old chip detector and its conclusion that it remained in the system. The evidence is replete with information that the Army knew everything about this old chip detector, which wasn't even part of odds. That was a chip detector in the device. The Army had legitimate policy reasons for keeping that in. Charlie Elkins, the logistics manager, his deposition was cited, said, we kept it in for reasons having nothing to do with other than the fact that some of these engines may go to non-odds equipped aircraft. And if we don't have that chip detector in there, these aircraft won't have a chip detector at all. And the second reason is, as Wayne Hudgens' affidavit points out very clearly, and it's completely uncontradicted by anything the plaintiffs brought up, he understood, as the aerospace engineer in charge of the research and development, the significance or lack thereof significance of leaving the old chip detector in place. Because the old chip detector was so inefficient, it captured at most 10% of the chips. So if you're still going to capture 90% of the chips, that old chip detector is going to be insignificant. Testimony of Ed Ritty that they want to refer to, where he says it would have been sound engineering to keep that hooked up, doesn't contradict anything about those statements. And Ed Ritty's statement, as the district judge found, is just a statement that it would have been sound engineering. It doesn't say Tedeco knew that somehow if you didn't keep this hooked up, you're going to have disasters occurring because it's not going to catch certain impending failures. So, with regard to those matters, we believe that the evidence shows that there wasn't anything that Tedeco knew about these two issues, the chip detector or the zapper, the pulse counter for the zapper, that the Army didn't know. And this was the Army's system. Tedeco supplied a zapper device and a lubriclone. Other manufacturers supplied other parts of the system. And it was the Army that conceived the research, the R&D program. The Army conducted the R&D program. The Army was in charge of the R&D program, and clearly we believe the evidence, particularly Wayne Hudgens' affidavit and his report, shows that the Army made the decisions on what to keep and what not to keep. So we believe the evidence shows that there is more than sufficient evidence, and there isn't a material issue of fact as to those issues, that the district court's position was correct and that the judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Winningham, or are you taking over, Mr. Wilson?
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, I'd like to address three comments that Mr. Moeller made, and I'd like to take them in reverse order. He comments upon the weight of the evidence going to the fact that Honeywell contracted to update the overhaul manual. Once you start weighing something, that's a question of fact for the jury. The whole premise with regard to the carrier assembly and the problems that we experienced has nothing to do with who made the carrier assembly, but rather they told us in the overhaul manual, take it apart into three pieces, clean it, inspect it, and measure it to see that it fits the drawings, then put it together and use it. They found out in 1991 that the minute you take that torque plate off of the front carrier, you lose datum C, and you will never have that carrier assembly aligned correctly again. They never told us anything about that, including right up to 6 months before this accident, when Jason Hannenberg and Tommy Bua, two engineers from Allied Signal, came to us, the Army, and said, hey, the problems you're having with these gears are caused by carrier assemblies. They're not properly aligned. Everybody knew that. The point of it is they didn't tell us how to fix them. Now, there is a difference, point number two, there is a difference between a design process or design defect and a manufacturing defect. We allege that there were carbide networks in the gear we purchased. By definition, Honeywell is the designer of that gear, which makes them a manufacturer, and the sale of that gear took place in 1991. It was installed in 1996. Therefore, they are a manufacturer of a defective gear that was sold within the statute. Secondly, well, let me switch quickly to Tedeco. There is a reason behind Boyle. And the reason is quite often the military, whether it be the Air Force, the Navy, or the Army, actually gets into the design of a product, whether it be a tank or an airplane or a helicopter. And they will share the drawings, there will be input back and forth, and you'll come up with the ultimate product. It's not nothing like what happens in civilian life. In this particular case, the drawings were never furnished because Tedeco didn't want the Army to have possession of those drawings.
But I don't understand what's so magic about the drawings if, in fact, there was this extremely interactive process between the Army and Tedeco over many years to see how exactly this thing was going to work in these particular helicopters and changes in configurations and all kinds of things seem to have happened. Just because one aspect wasn't interactive doesn't mean that the thing as a whole couldn't be.
May it please the court, it was a 10-year elaborate process, 100,000 flying hours, but every single hour was a testing hour. It was not a design hour. It was not spent in analyzing the design. What we were
so
trying.
When they changed the width, you don't think that has to do with the design? They decided to make it a little wider so that it wouldn't be quite so sensitive.
That has to do with changing the size of the fuzz or the microphone.
I understand. I'm just saying it's hard to see why you couldn't characterize that as a slight change in the overall design of the product for that use.
I don't think that changes the design of the Zapper at all. What it does is change the activation level of it. But it doesn't, the design principle is still the same.
Well, you have a very tight definition of design then, it seems to me.
Well, I just think there's a vast difference between helping design a product, whether it be the whole fighter airplane or just a system that's going to be installed. And remember, the odd system is installed on the airframe, not on the engine. So being installed on the airframe directly relates to this whole magnetic check detector, as Mr. Eikenberry pointed out.
But if they hadn't changed this thing, it would have detected much smaller particles, wouldn't it? Which is the whole thing you say it should have done.
But it would have burned off smaller particles, but it would also have set the light off for larger particles. Chip light, I'm not talking about now. Not the Zephyr carrier, but in the cockpit, yes, it would. Smaller particles would have activated the chip light.
So the kinds of changes they were made were directly relevant to the complaints that you have about the way this thing was put together, I'll say, to avoid the use of the word design.
I don't think that we have any, are quarreling with the design. We're saying Boyle isn't there because they can't pass the first prong of the Boyle test.
Right.
And
well,
what we're saying that is an integral part isn't. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel, and thanks to all four counsel. The case is taken under advisement.